Good morning again. Thank you for being here to share the Dharma this morning. And thank you also to the people who have been here since Friday night. Your practice helps our practice. Today we'll work on a koan from the Hekigan Roku, or the Blue Cliff Record. This will be case number 43, Dungshan's No Cold or Heat. The Blue Cliff Record is the second of the classical collections that we work with in our formal koan study in this lineage at this temple. It's a little different from the Wu Men Kan in that it's something of a composite work. The Wu Men Kan is the work of one person, Master Wu Men, whose Japanese name is Mumon. The Blue Cliff Record, on the other hand, is the work of two highly respected Zen teachers. The original compiler was Master Shui Do, whose Japanese name is Secho. He collected 100 public cases and added a few remarks and a verse to each one. Then about 60 years following his death, Yuan Wu, whom we know in Japanese as Engo, wrote an introductory paragraph called a pointer, added line-by-line comments, and a teisho on each of the cases, and he added line-by-line comments and a teisho on each of the verses. So the Blue Cliff Record became a huge work. And while Yan Wu's lengthy commentaries are great fun to nose around in when you're working on these koans, today we'll deal only with the public case and Shui Do's verse. Case number 43 in the Blue Cliff Record. A monk asked Dungshan, "When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them?" Shan said, "Why don't you go to the place where there is no cold or heat?" The monk said, "What is that place where there is no cold or heat?" Dungshan said, "When it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you." And Shui Do's verse. He lets down his hand, but still it's the same as a 10,000-fathom cliff. Why must correct and biased be in an arrangement? The ancient crystal palace reflects the bright moon. The sly hound of Han vainly runs up the stairs. There are two Dungshans, whose Japanese names would be Tozan. There are two of them in our lineage. We chant both their names in the ancestral line, which we just completed this morning. The one we're dealing with here is Liang Che of Dungshan Mountain, who lived from 806 to 869 of the Common Era. The other, Shou Chu Tsung Hui of Tungshan, lived from 900 to 990, quite a bit later. He was the one who got roughed up by Yunmen in case number 15 in the Woman Khan. But this is the earlier Dungshan. Dungshan the Elder, we might call him. Dungshan traveled about quite a bit when he was a younger man. That was the custom of Chan monks at that time. Among others, he visited Nanchuan, Kuishan, and then Yunyan, under whose guidance he had a great awakening. But it wasn't entirely complete. His doubts continued until one day he crossed a bridge over a river and saw his reflection in the water. Then it all came together, and he composed a verse acknowledging his teacher, Yunyan. "Just avoid seeking from others, or you will be far estranged from yourself. I now go on alone. I meet him everywhere. He is now just as I, but I now am not he. One must understand this way in order to unite with thusness." He is now just as I, but I am not he. Dungshan at once sees with his teacher's eye, yet he is his own man. That's really what it's about. Dzogchen is also known for his formulation of the five ranks of practice and realization, which we work on also as part of the formal curriculum here. One of Dzogchen's successors was named Zaoshan, whose Japanese name is Sozan. This is a kind of shadowy character whose very existence is doubted in some circles. But he is said to have taken many of Dzogchen's teaching and publicized them. So the names of Dzogchen and Zaoshan were combined to create the name of the Zhao Dong school, which in Japanese is Soto. So we owe a great deal to these two as founders of our Zen lineage. A monk asked Dzogchen, "When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them?" Shan said, "Why don't you go to the place where there is no cold or heat?" The monk said, "What is that place where there is no cold or heat?" Dzogchen said, "When it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you." When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? A monk asks a teacher. That's important. It is for the student to have the question. It's for the monk to ask the teacher. Teachers hold out a hand to help us, to guide us, to keep us from falling into a pit, or if we do, to help us out. But the original question, the original desire to know, has to come from within, each one of us. That question comes in many forms. Does the dog have the Buddha nature or not? What is the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the West? What is Buddha? What is the way? This monk puts it a little bit differently. When cold and heat come, how can we avoid them? This monk's asking about suffering. What about it? When cold and heat come, what about suffering, hunger, thirst, disease, old age, loss, conflict, death? This is a question that Siddhartha Gautama was faced with when he saw an old man, a sick man, and a dead man. And it drove him to deep introspection and ultimately to full enlightenment. And this is the first noble truth. The truth of suffering. Anguish and suffering are everywhere. Our monk has recognized the fact of suffering, so he's already come a long way. Just to acknowledge our own suffering is a huge step, and it's a difficult one. Suffering is not always obvious, not even to the one who suffers. In the ordinary way of things, we often don't recognize our own suffering, much less that of others. When we give our public seminars here, I don't know how many people come here and say that they've discovered suffering and desperately need to resolve the issue. I suspect not many. Most suffering is a kind of subliminal, vague, ill-defined discontent. The Sanskrit word for suffering is dukkha, the wheel that doesn't turn true on its axle. We can go for a long time with that wheel just slightly out of kilter before we even notice it, let alone try to do something about it. Even if we recognize suffering through a personal experience of tragedy, we don't always recognize its universality. There's a famous tale of the woman whose child had died, and she came to the Buddha and pleaded with him as the great miracle worker to restore her child to life. The Buddha agreed to do it on the condition that she bring him a mustard seed from a household that had never known death. So the woman went from house to house throughout the whole village, and of course she was unable to find a single household that had not known the sorrow of death. And so she learned that suffering and anguish are everywhere. Everywhere. It's easy to divide the world very neatly into victims and oppressors. We go to rallies and meetings and marches to express solidarity with victims. But be careful. Those whom we categorize as the evil oppressors are victims in their own way. They suffer in their own way. We can easily condemn a corrupt policeman. But that policeman who accepts bribes has a family to feed. And he has to pay off the police official who gave him his job. He doesn't pay off that guy, he loses his job. And that police official has to pay the higher official who gave him his job. And the higher official has to pay off an even higher official, and so it goes. In a situation like that, everyone is afraid, everyone suffers, everyone is part of the food chain of fear. Do not think that suffering belongs only to those whom we define as victims. Suffering is in the refugee camps of Gaza and the West Bank and in the Israeli Knesset. It's in the streets of Baghdad and the presidential palaces. It's in the ghettos of Harlem and in the White House. There's a real danger in suffering that's not recognized, not acknowledged, not owned. This unowned suffering, this suffering that is denied, is often converted to anger and hatred and passed on. Those who inflict suffering on others are themselves suffering. Those who try to instill fear in others are themselves fearful. If I am unable to own my own suffering, if I cannot cry my own tears, if I cannot feel my own pain, I will try to make others feel that pain for me. I will try to make others cry my tears for me. Someone said after the Columbine shootings a few years ago, if a child cannot cry tears, he will cry bullets. That unacknowledged suffering and anguish is passed around like a virus. Until one day, someone says, okay, I hurt, but this hurt stops with me. I will not pass it on. That in itself is a tremendous act of courage and self-sacrifice. To deny our own suffering, or the suffering of anyone else, is a violation of the precept, the first precept, not to kill. In denying suffering, we kill the mind that experiences suffering. The mind that hears the cries of the world, which are our own cries. And it is only that mind that knows suffering that can awaken. Do not kill the mind that suffers. Do not kill the mind that can awaken. But to return to the monk's question, how do we avoid suffering? Heat, cold, all the rest of it. Can we avoid them? It's a bit like asking, how can I avoid my life? Is the monk serious here? Is he asking about his own suffering, cry of the heart? Master, I'm hurting. How do I escape from all this? Or is he challenging Dongshan? Let's see how you do it, old man. It doesn't really matter. The question that's important. And Dongshan takes this monk at his word, and he answers, why don't you go to the place where there is no cold or heat? Is that the answer? Go to that place where, oh yeah, go to where there's no heat, no cold, no self, no other, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no color, smells, sound, taste, touch, or what the mind takes hold of. No birth, no death, no man, no woman, no Buddhas, no ordinary beings. No heat or cold to be experienced, no one to experience it, no experiencing. Nirvana. It's a neat place, this place of no place, a place of nothing at all. Of the peace that passes all understanding. Utter peace, utter emptiness. Yeah, go to the place where there's no cold or heat. And is that really it? Is that where we want to hang out? Where we make our abode? If one looks at the ten ox herding pictures, this is the eighth one, the empty circle. And there's two more to go. So maybe that's not quite it. Every day in Sesshin, we recite the line, to be attached to things is illusion, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. People are often reluctant to leave Sesshin. After 6 days of striving for the great silence, who would ever want to muck it up with words and thoughts? That's the reason so much planning and thought has gone into that last day of Sesshin, to ease us back into the world of time and space, houses, mortgages, kids, jobs, all the rest of it, the full catastrophe. It's often harder to move in that direction than it was to go into the silence in the first place. I suspect we've all occasionally had these rather romantic notions about practice. I know I did. I dreamed of going off someplace into the mountains or the desert and just sitting on my own, getting full enlightenment, and then enjoying that solitary splendor forever. It's a tempting idea. In fact, it was the last temptation of the Buddha. Mara, the deceiver, tried to persuade the Buddha to just hang out by the river and live in this nirvanic bliss forever. Hey, don't bother to go out there and teach. It's not worth it. Suppose the Buddha had stayed there. Would anybody have ever heard of him? Would he even have been the Buddha? But he didn't stay there. And neither can we. To try to stay there is called making your living in a ghost cave. But if everybody did that, we wouldn't have much of a society either. As Robert Aitken never tires of pointing out, we're all in this together. Emphasis on together. But how do we leave that place? Where do we go? And are we changed? That brings us to the monk's next question. What is the place where there is no cold or heat? Give the monk full marks here. He isn't satisfied with Dungshan's initial answer. Now, maybe he's just naive and doesn't understand at all what Dungshan is talking about. Maybe he's really just pushing the master. Come on, boss. Show me this place of no heat or cold. Let's see it. Either way, give him credit. Now, Dungshan answers. But this time it's different. He doesn't go on trying to explain about nirvana. And he doesn't sit silent either. He refuses to get stuck in emptiness, or worse yet, in concepts about emptiness. He's not going to hang out there, and he isn't about to let the monk, or us, do it either. He takes us the next step. When it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. Yeah, now there's heat. Now there's cold. There's traffic tickets, dirty laundry, air sickness. There is this world. How does the cold kill you? How does the heat kill you? The cold kills you only if you let it. The heat kills you only if you let it. Only when you come from that place of nothing at all. When you come naked into the world, utterly open, utterly vulnerable. Only then does the heat, cold, light, dark, traffic, laundry, kill you. And who is it that's killed? The I, the separated, attached self from which it all arises in the first place. A monk walking in the mountains sees peach blossoms and comes to awakening. The blossoms killed him. A monk hears a pebble strike a stalk of bamboo and comes to awakening. The sound killed him. A Sesshin participant walking home hears a train whistle and comes to awakening. He was killed. A 35-year-old man sitting under a bow tree in northern India sees the morning star. Well, we all know about that one. What did all these guys have in common? They heard or saw from that place of emptiness. There was no peach blossom separate from Master Ryuin. There was no sound of a bamboo separate from Xiangyan, whom we know as Kyozan. It's that realization that we often call the enlightenment experience. Now, this is not always, or even usually, about full enlightenment, or the gangbusters Kensho. It's what happens in daily practice. Every time we sit on the mat, we enter the place of silence, maybe just a little bit. And every time we emerge, we're a little more open, a little more receptive to what's around us. And the cold, the heat, and everything else is a little more real, because the self that reacts, comments, approves, disapproves, wishes, wants, rejects, and so forth, is a little bit less. We die the great death by inches. We can break it down into three easy steps. Step one, Zazen. We sit on the mat, become silent. We go to that place where there is no heat or cold. There's nothing at all. This is touching the mind. Step two, we open up to the world, to our lives, to the suffering. We hear as the Bodhisattva Kanon hears the cries of the world. The heat kills you. The cold kills you. This is receiving the mind. Then and only then can we go on to step three. We go into the world, and without effort, without a consciousness of I helping you, we convey the mind. Dongshan took the monk through the first two steps, and the rest is our responsibility. As the Buddha showed us, by getting up from under the Bodhi tree and going out into the world. Without taking that last step, the first two have no meaning. Robert Ikkin Roshi warns us that if our enlightenment does not function in the world, it's just an esoteric hobby. But without taking those first two steps, that last one has no real effect. It's just more thrashing around in the world of delusion. You can't skip any of the steps. If one is not grounded in emptiness, one cannot see the oneness. The heat and cold remain separate. The self remains separate, and therefore frustrated, hurting, and ineffective. Now, all that sounds very linear, and of course it's not really like that. Even as we sit in silence and touch the mind, we open up to the sounds and smells of the world. They become us. We receive the mind. Even as we sit up straight, in unmovable dignity like a mountain, we convey the mind. Even as we are mindful in our daily lives, we are a little quieter and a little closer to that place of no heat or cold. With sincere practice, it's all happening at once. To do this in the context of lay practice is a huge, huge challenge. To see a star, to see a flower, and to see Buddha is easy. To see a homeless person, to see a thief, a murderer, Saddam Hussein, George Bush, and to see Buddha is not so easy. But as Sensei has pointed out many times, we don't have to wait until we're fully enlightened. If we practice sincerely and correctly, it just happens. And eventually we go beyond notions of steps one, two, or three. A tree doesn't think about giving shade. One of the famous stories about Mother Teresa of Calcutta referred to the sick and the starving in the streets as Jesus in his more distressing disguises. When another cries out, I cry out. When I cry out, the universe cries out. When I attend the cries of just one person, the universe attends. Does this sound self-centered? It is non-centered. Shwedo's verse. He lets down a hand, but it's still the same as a 10,000 fathom cliff. Why must correct and biased be in an arrangement? The ancient crystal palace reflects the bright moon. The sly hound of Han vainly runs up the stairs. Dongshan and all our teachers hold out a hand to us. But no teacher, not even the Buddha, ever gave anybody enlightenment. Each one of us has to do it for ourselves. Each one of us has to climb that 10,000 fathom cliff. There's no shortcuts. The hand can guide us, save us a lot of time that we might otherwise waste, caught in fruitless error. But we have to do the heavy lifting. We have to do the practice. And without the practice, without the zazen, that hand, no matter how generous, no matter how supportive, is of no use at all. Why must correct and biased be in an arrangement? Now, this is a good question. I think Shwedo is taking a bit of a dig at Dongshan here. As we mentioned, Dongshan formulated the five ranks of practice and realization. This is a series of verses in which he sets out how we progress through our experience and understanding of the relationship of form and emptiness and how they eventually come together. But here Shwedo asks, why must correct, i.e. emptiness, the absolute, so-called void, and biased, the world of time, space, thoughts, opinions, delusion, and so forth, ever be an arrangement in juxtaposition to each other? We speak of two arrows meeting in midair. Were there ever two arrows to begin with? We speak of fitting a box, of two fitting together like a box and a lid. Was there ever a separate box and a lid? The moment we think of form, emptiness, correct, biased, we're in dualism. We've lost the transcendent reality that's not empty and not diluted. All these are analogies, expedient means, but they're not the reality. Don't get hung up. It's not about having the right thoughts about enlightenment. No thought will ever reach it. On the other hand, we talk about it. The Dharma can be transmitted with words and concepts if, grounded in our zazen, we can see beyond all that to the reality. Ultimately, there is no form, no emptiness. There's just the traffic. There's just the silence of the snow. The ancient crystal palace reflects the bright moon. The ancient crystal palace has 1,000 panes, 1,000,000 panes. Each one reflects the bright moon in 1,000 ways. But is it all the same moon? Is it? Is it one? Is it many? And just what is this palace? It's a little bit similar to another very beautiful image that one sees in Buddhist literature. The image of the net of Indra that consists of an infinite network of jewels, each jewel reflecting all the others. The sly hound of Han vainly runs up the stairs. This is a clever dog. He chases up the stairs, down the stairs, searching in all the rooms. Yan Wu asks, what rabbit is he looking for? Yes, we strive after something that's already here. We practice to become something that we already are. But is it really in vain? If we do not strive, if we do not practice, how will we ever find out that it's already there? That we already are, whole and complete. There's another translation of that line that has it, the hound runs up the stairs and finds it empty. Now that's not in vain. Not at all. It's okay to be that monk, to keep on questioning. It's okay to be the hound as well. Whatever our level of understanding, wherever we are in our practice, in our lives, that's where we work from. The point is to keep on working. Of course, there will be failure, disappointment with our formal practice and with the world and with ourselves. But that's just part of the process. The heat, the cold, the disappointments, the suffering become our practice. They become the breath. They become the mu. And so does joy, happiness, and peace. There is no other. T.S. Eliot wrote, "The end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Thank you.